This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Recreational marijuana is now legal in Ohio, and although you can't buy it anywhere legally quite yet, you can grow a limited number of plants. Today on our gardening show, we have an expert here who can offer advice on growing cannabis indoors and outside. We also have experts who will talk about when it's safe to transplant your seedlings outside, especially those tomato and pepper plants, and answer questions about all kinds of fruits and vegetables, flowers and shrubs, and how to manage pests. Joining me now for this full hour of gardening, our Civic Garden Center Ecology Education Manager, Mary Dudley. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Extension Educator for Hamilton County, Joe Boggs. Thanks for being here, Joe.
Glad to be here.
Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Manager of Botanical Garden Outreach, Scott Berline. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you.
And Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer, Peter Huttinger. Thanks for being here, Peter.
Yeah, hello. Everyone.
Great. Yeah, great to have everybody here. The Cincinnati Zoo is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Okay, we know you've got questions for our experts, so give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Mary, let's start with cannabis. Is this an expensive plant to grow successfully? What do gardeners really need to keep in mind?
So that's a wonderful question to start with. Really, it depends on your level of dedication and how, I guess, you want your production value to end up. I personally have spent quite a bit of investment on my growing spaces and my different inputs. But at the same time, this is a plant that's fairly easy to grow. If you just stick a seed in a pot, it will probably produce something for you.
Okay. I know you have a course at the Civic Garden Center that covers tips for growing cannabis outside and indoors. Is one a lot more difficult than the other?
Since we are considering this to be a medicinal plant that you are consuming at some point, we actually are promoting more indoor growing than outdoor growing. There's just a lot of other factors outside that you cannot control. And so if you do decide to grow outside in the growing season, we recommend having something that you can transfer inside, especially with a storm like we had last night. But otherwise, most of our information is about hydroponic or soil gardening indoors.
Okay. Okay. And if you do decide you're going to just go to outdoor growing, because what the heck, is there a particular season that's best for that?
Yeah, so it would follow our normal gardening season. I do want to recommend that listeners look into their own municipality regulations on that. There are going to be different regulations for different municipalities, and some folks might not be able to grow outside unless it is contained in some way. So just be on the lookout for that.
Okay. And so what if you're recommending growing inside to kind of have a little bit more control over the end product and all that good stuff? What kind of soil does your plant need? What do you really need to be successful for indoor growing?
Yeah, we really want you to be able to make this investment work for you and to be able to grow your own medicine that you can rely on. This is a wonderful opportunity for people that are looking to be able to pick their own strains, to be able to control what terpenes and cannabinoids they're consuming, and really be totally confident that what they're taking is organic and reliable. So we would recommend a living soil. Tilth is a Cleveland-based company that produces a soil called Bloom that is recommended. There are a couple other living soils. You can get a lot of wonderful things at our local stores. Growing Trade over in Northside has a good amount of information, and also Fab Ferments has some of this tilth soil. If you're going to be growing hydroponically, you want to make sure that you're getting good nutrients. Garden Grove Organics in Kentucky can provide those things. But at the same time, you know, if you have good gardening methods that you've used in the past, you've got your little nitrogen mix from your, you know, coffee grounds or something that you like to use, definitely go and lean into those experiences that you have had. We definitely don't recommend anything with slow release fertilizers, because those will get into the plant and then you're just not sure if you're going to be consuming that or not. So anything that you use, please go organic and use living things as much as you can.
Okay. And do you need a lot of space for this? Are there, or I've heard you need lights, and what kind of temperature control do you need? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this plant really has two distinct growing phases, and it has a vegetative state that wants a little bit more humidity. We're talking upwards of 70% humidity, nice and warm. So really that greenhouse effect when you walk into Crone Conservatory and you feel it's all warm in there, that's what your plants want when it first starts out. When it starts to transfer into the flowering phase, this is when it has less light. You're going to be switching your light cycles from 18:6 to 12:12, and that humidity should decrease so that you don't get the possibility of mold and mildews coming onto your plants. So you want to be able to have these different growth requirements. Now, that being said, I have two grow tents in my basement. This is the first crop I've ever grown. I got my seeds in December, just had my first harvest and my first trim a couple of weeks ago. And the investment that I've made on those growth chambers really has benefited all of my gardening expertise. I'm growing native plant seedlings and things for the community garden. So if you make that investment, you'll be able to use it in other ways. But if you're growing outdoors, you know, you just want to be going into good soil that you've composted and paying attention to those weather events and whether or not you can protect that plant.
Okay. Well, I know, as I mentioned, you've got a course at the Civic Garden Center that's sold out, but it sounds like you're going to keep offering those. There must be a lot of interest in this.
Yeah, the mission of the Civic Garden Center really aligns with our education access. We want this to be equitable. We want it to be available for anyone who wants it. So we'll keep having classes. They do sell out very quickly, but we'll continue to have them on a monthly basis so that we can really give people what they're looking for. In the meantime, if you can't get into a class, you can go ahead and email us at Civic Garden Center, and we will get you on with our newsletter and connect you with other people in the community that want to be helpful.
Okay. Well, let's broaden our discussion a little bit. Joe, what's the last frost date in Southwest Ohio? That's an important thing that we, all of our gardeners, are always thinking about.
Well, the last frost date is when we don't see any more frost.
Well, there you have it. Okay, we'll just end the show right here.
You heard it here first. No, that is something that slips and slides around, and it's based on averages. And originally, and I'm sure Scott can jump in on this too, well, Peter and Mary, because, you know, at one time we used to say, well, it was around May 15th, and then it started sliding back towards, you know, early May. And you'll even see some dates, you know, that are late April, because, again, it depends on the range of data that you're looking at, the more the better. But, again, average, meaning that, you know, even though we declare a frost-free date, it doesn't mean it's free of frost, because on average you could have a late-season frost. I would not necessarily use that, though, as a guide for planting. I mean, you know, we need to be reasonable, not go too early. But, for example, if people want to start planting some of the sensitive plants right now, well, they can get away with it as long as they know two things. Number one is that soil temperatures are everything. And if the temperatures, as they rise, you'll see more root growth and establishment. But the second point there is just be mindful of the weather. And if you have a few tomato plants out, for example, and it's a frost or a freeze, hopefully not that, is predicted, then you can go out and cover them and pull the covering off.
Okay. Peter, what date are you using this year?
So the rule of thumb for me is always between Mother's Day and the 18th of May. At one point was the USDA standard date. But, you know, the thing to kind of remember, at the Price Hill Community Garden, we have a half acre. We'll put out 50, 60 tomatoes. So I'm not going to mess around. I'm not going to put them out too early. If you're at home and you're putting out two or three tomatoes and you have sort of a sheltered area and you can go out and tent them or cover them up and protect them if you get a cold frost, then it might be worthwhile experimenting. But generally, we won't be putting our tomatoes out in the gardens for another week or two.
What about peppers, Peter?
Same thing. Peppers, I find even more tender, and so I'm much more protective of them.
Okay. Yeah. So Peter, what, in your view, is the best timing for transplanting seedlings and bedding plants and sowing seeds?
Okay. Well, the different seeds, all different plants have different conditions. So, for instance, peas, you can put peas in April. And you direct sowing. And beans, you usually wait a couple weeks after that. If you're planting soybeans are actually much more tender, and so you can't really put them in. You know, a lot of people wait to around June 1st or the last week of May at the earliest to put those in. And so those are things to kind of consider.
Okay.
But, you know, your brassicas, your cabbages and stuff, we put those in early, mid-April. You can actually direct sow carrots in January and February. You have to put some straw or some row cover over the top of them, and they'll slowly germinate over time. And so we do that each year.
Okay.
So I've, I guess if someone has a question about a specific plant, call in and we'll try and address that specific plant. There's so many variants.
There you go. It's
keep
a full
your eye
hour.
On the 10-day. You know, the 10-day forecast is your friend.
Yeah.
As you're debating, you know, whether to go outside or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I always say, read the seed package. There's a lot of basic information there. It'll answer a lot of that depth of seeds and things like that.
Reading is your friend. It's a full hour of gardening today, and we have a panel of experts ready to answer your questions. The number to call is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Scott, we had some emails left over from our last gardening show because it's just so darn popular. Here's one from Susan. Susan wrote, "We received a southern magnolia as a gift about a year and a half ago. I planted it last spring and it grew about twice its size. My question is, what can I do to help it through the next few winters? And do we even have a chance to keep it alive?"
Well, there's a lot of southern magnolias that grow quite well around here and further north. The issue kind of becomes which southern magnolia is it, because it does depend on the selection. So if it's one of the good hardy selections, of which there are about five that are reasonably available, then no problem. It should be fine. If it's not one of those, don't even bother, because you're always going to worry about it every year. It doesn't matter if it's young or if it's older, if it's going to be a 30, you know, a minus 20 winter, which is plausible, still possible, I guess. It'll either, you know, take all the leaves off and weaken the plant or kill it. So if they can find out which one it is and then maybe send a question in or that in, then I could better answer that question.
Okay. You need to know more specifics about that magnolia.
Exactly.
Okay. We did have a call earlier from Peter. Peter did not stay on the line, but he wanted a boxwood update. And Joe, that's going to you. I know last year, 2023, was the year of the boxwood here on the gardening show. We talked a lot about it. What's the latest on boxwoods these days?
Well, the good news and bad news is the caterpillars have emerged from their winter overwintering stage, so they're feeding heavily right now. So the good news is that you can now see the damage. I know that sounds kind of funny. So, for example, I'm getting a lot of pictures from the only areas that we know them to exist, that would be the general Loveland area, extending west, actually all the way almost to Interstate 75. So you kind of think of this blotch, you know, of an area where we might find box tree moth caterpillars. If we have listeners by chance up in the Dayton area, just south of Dayton is another hot spot. So you can now see the caterpillars feeding. They're easy to kill. There's just about any of the over-the-counter materials, including Bacillus thuringiensis, a natural occurring bacterium, will kill them. So that's the good news. The bad news, though, is that we do not know exactly where they exist. You might think, well, I just said they're going to be in this area. However, remember, we didn't find this non-native pest in our area until mid-June last year, so we're still looking, and so we still want listeners to be on the lookout, and even if you're in the general area that I just described, it's not a bad idea to contact the Ohio Department of Agriculture just to let them know what you're seeing, because we need to also know the extent of the populations and spread. So that's the general update. Another update, though, is that we've put together a really nice team to address this issue, including Teresa Colley at University of Cincinnati. She's actually doing genetic testing on boxwoods, and the connection there is that we know that there's a range of susceptibility among all boxwood species, varieties, and cultivars. And so long-term, we are predicting that we will be able to handle the problem by just planting boxwoods that, you know, these caterpillars don't heavily infest. And the genetic connection allows us to make sure we know exactly which boxwoods we're talking about in the host preference trials.
And has the determination that the boxwood moths were causing more of the damage than we suspected earlier in the year last year? Or I know we talked about all the different things that were really giving boxwoods a run for their money last year.
Yeah, and that is unfortunately continuing. So what you're referring to, Lucy, is last year it was really unfortunate because In my entire career, boxwoods never looked worse because during the week of December 2022, we had some deep diving temperatures that damaged the stems on boxwoods. Not all of them, and it was very random. And then those stems commonly became infected with two different fungi that led to a disease called Volutella blight and canker. And the canker part's very important. So that fungal disease progresses down the stem. You can prune it out if you cut below the canker, so you're looking for dark areas on the stem. But unfortunately, people just didn't do that. I mean, I'm still seeing boxwoods that are progressing in terms of the infection. So we're still seeing some boxwoods that are looking pretty bad. On the other hand, the new growth that's happening this spring is really going gangbusters. And so, you know, the boxwoods didn't get damaged this past winter. And again, I say, kind of the good news, that is allowing people to see these caterpillars, which are not being masked by this other problem.
Okay. Don't have a lot of boxwoods at the zoo, do you, Scott?
Not anymore. No.
Yeah, the caterpillars ate them, didn't they?
We have some, but it's not one that we use a lot.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, it's kind of fallen out of favor.
It really has.
Yeah. We got another call from Philip, and he didn't stay on the line. His question was, where can you get seeds in local stores in the Dayton area or online, if not in stores? We're not sure if Philip was referring to cannabis seeds, which would go to you, Mary. What do you have any advice about that?
Yeah, so you can actually order cannabis seeds online from many different companies. And so if you are looking for that, you can order them legally. They can be shipped to your home. But if you would like something in person, the store that we're recommending is Wildberry, which is in Oxford, Ohio. So for Dayton, it's a little bit of a drive, but they have a lot of different autoflower and photo period seeds, and they have wonderful staff that can help you make a choice.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. For vegetable seeds, there's a lot of good online sources. I don't know the Dayton area specifically, but earlier today, Growing Trade was mentioned by Mary. They have a good selection of seeds, as do a lot of local nurseries. But Johnny Seed, High Mowing Seeds is another good one. And do you have any other? I was trying to remember.
Johnny's is my favorite.
Yeah.
Too,
yeah. And so, but there's a number of things on seeds. And I do encourage people that, whenever possible, to do seeds that are organically produced. Seeds of Change is another one, has a lot of interesting heirlooms.
Mm. Okay. Anything for flowery plants that you want to recommend, Scott?
If you really want to go deep dive on like perennial seeds, Gelato Seeds is really interesting. They mostly produce for growers, so they sell by the pound. But they also sell everything in packs. And another one I really like is Prairie Moon Nursery, which is a prairie company, and they sell prairie species in $3 packs, which is pretty cool to see.
Okay. Well, we are going to be back with our gardening show in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We've got a full hour of gardening for you today and a panel of experts here to answer your questions. My guests are Civic Garden Center Ecology Education Manager Mary Dudley, Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Extension Educator for Hamilton County, Joe Boggs, Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Manager of Botanical Garden Outreach, Scott Berline, and Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer, Peter Huttinger. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. We have some more emails left over from last gardening show. Peter, I'm going to send this one your way. Is there a good way to keep the neighbor's cat from digging in our yard or keeping it out of the yard altogether? This is from Nancy in Newport. Also, Nancy asks, do you know of any effective raccoon deterrent?
Yeah. Well, with cats, I've had good luck with just putting up. One thing you can do is using chicken wire poultry fencing, a low little section of it that's kind of loose and wobbly around the garden bed. The cats often get kind of tricked, and they don't like the floppiness of it. But also, we had a problem with that in one of the community gardens, and we used it was a mixture of a couple different oils, but one of them was mint and lavender and a citrus oil that we kind of mixed together like an essential oil, and you mix in a little bit of water, and you actually, with a spray bottle, spray the wooden raised bed box edge. And that greatly reduced. I can't say it 100%, but that greatly reduced. And then in terms of, you know, other critters kind of getting in, I mean, was it squirrels?
Raccoons.
Raccoons, yep. Yeah. You know, raccoons are just, I mean, they're really hard.
Yep.
You know, but
those little
again,
tricky hands.
Yes. And but another thing you can do, too, is that if you have a fence around your garden, you know, you can make it as tall as you want. They'll crawl over. But again, that floppy kind of thing on the top, there was a gardener I knew had a lot of problem with them in Washington Park. And he actually put the about 2 foot high chicken poultry wire on top of his regular 4 foot fence, but had it very, very kind of floppy, and it would just confuse him and frustrate him. And he said he had good luck with that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's where I got the idea actually of doing it with the cats, just only lower down.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Well, thank you. We've got some callers waiting. Let's go to Jim. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I've got blueberry bushes, and they're getting some sort of a mossy-looking fungus that's growing on them. I've seen the same thing grow like on fence posts, and I don't know why they're getting it. Is it something I need to be concerned about, or can I get rid of it?
Good question. Peter, you want to take a stab at that one?
Well, you could use things like flowable copper or fungicides to take care of that, and there are organic ones, and that is a problem. But one of the things that you really need to do is to make sure that there's good airflow around the plants, and blueberries in particular really need a lot of sun. They need a lot of air moving around them. So if you have them planted very close together and they're kind of growing into each other and forming a kind of a hedge, that's what you really don't want. Actually, sometimes we've tried in the community garden, we planted alternating low bush and high bush varieties with the idea of trying to keep more space and air around them. But this spacing is very critical about that.
Yeah. Hope that helps, Jim.
Can I ask exactly where are the growths on the blueberries?
They're like on the trunks.
Yeah, I think it's probably, you might want to look and go online and look this up. It sounds more like lichens, which are, a composite organism, and they're pretty common on blueberries, particularly in our area, because our high soil pH, even when you address that, and Peter, you know this, you have to really be mindful of keeping the pH high, I mean the pH low. Whoa, yeah. I really did something bad there, acidifying the soil. So our blueberries often aren't as thick as we might see them elsewhere where you have acidic soils. And lichens are a combination of fungi, plural, and something that can feed the mutualism, something that has photosynthesis, like an alga or a cyanobacterium. So those two things are growing together. The fungus is providing the scaffolding, and the alga or the cyanobacterium is providing the food. And where you have stems that are exposed to the sunlight, the lichens will proliferate. They cause no harm whatsoever. They're just simply using the plant, you know, as a location, but they can be mistaken for other things.
Interesting.
That sounds exactly like what I've got.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling, Jim. We appreciate it. We have Kathy on the line. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for calling. What is your question?
Yes, I want to talk about the dreaded aphids. Last year, our aphids just plagued our neighbor because our tree hangs over their driveway, and it was awful, and we wanted to just, it's a hackberry, we wanted to just cut it down, but they said, no, don't cut it down. And then my husband got these weird pellets that he put underneath the tree this year after, I guess in about March. But I just wonder, are aphids coming again?
Joe, you're a bug guy.
Yeah. This is very interesting. And if you wouldn't mind, if you're seeing them now, I'd sure like to know the location. If you'd, want to supply that some way.
We haven't seen any yet, but I just wonder.
Okay. Well, here's what I think you have, and why I'm interested is this is a non-native invasive. It's called the Asian woolly hackberry aphid. And we started seeing it last year in high numbers. It's not new. It doesn't cause any great harm to the tree. But they, as you've described, are serious nuisance pests because you get these huge numbers. They're called woolly aphids because, or I like the word aphids. I like that. It's tomato, tomato. You know, we say them differently. But they cover themselves in this white flocculent material. And then when they come raining down, that's a problem. Plus, they're prolific producers of this sticky honeydew. And so those two things taken together, we really don't want to see trees heavily infested, but there's not much we can do about it other than it sounds like maybe your husband is looking at a systemic insecticide. But we do want to know what these populations are doing because we have a lot of hackberries in our area. And when these things really, you know, build in populations, you'll start seeing this, you know, fluffy material floating through the air, and that will generate a lot of questions. So if you do see them, I'd sure like for you to contact me. I'd like to be able to come by and take a look and to establish the location so I can kind of keep track of this.
Okay, I will be happy to do that.
Okay, well, thanks, Mary. Thanks for Kathy, sorry. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. We have now Phyllis on the line. Hi, Phyllis. Thank you so much for calling. What's your question?
Hello. Yes. I'm wondering about shocking the plants, the cannabis. Years ago, grew four plants. Long story short, it wasn't legal then, and pulled them out of the ground, replanted them somewhere else, then brought them back sometime later, and had this growth of plants that the trunks looked like bonsai, and they were just plentiful of bloom and buds. So I'm wondering if there's something to it about shocking a plant when it's in mid-growth.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for being a legacy grower. None of what we're doing right now would be possible without the people that have been growing for a long time. So thank you for that. But yes, this plant will start to get into its main flowering phase and be very productive when it is stressed. And so that's what we're doing with the limited light cycle. When we flip it into the flowering phase, we also want to reduce that stress, though, because we really want the females. This is a dioecious plant that has both male and female flowers on separate plants. And so we don't really want to stress it out on purpose because that could cause that female plant to become hermaphroditic. And so if you are not trying to produce a bunch of seeds, which most of us probably are not, then you don't want to add that extra stress. But that's probably what you were observing was, oh my gosh, I really need to reproduce, because that is kind of the life goal of plant species. And so when they feel stressed, they really will go into overdrive there. But if you're able to control those conditions and be patient, like I said, I did my first crop this year and it took about 6 months to come to fruition, then you're able to control more of those factors and have it be a slower time. If you're not able to really take advantage of that amount of time, then you can consider an autoflower plant versus a photoperiod. Autoflowering plants that are feminized will have a shorter growth phase because they are not light dependent. They'll be just going on the length of maturity that they have. But I would not recommend on purpose shocking, but that's probably what you were seeing.
Yes. And one final comment, it's really seeds, seeds, seeds. It's like anything you grow, it's the species itself. It's the plant kind. So yeah. I had saved seeds from probably all over the place, being a teenager when I began. But so some plants were squatty, short, full of bud. I had another one that looked like a huge hydrangea. So I had different kinds, and I could tell by the growth itself. And I found that was interesting by smell, by taste, yeah, by bud, by everything.
I agree. The amount of strains that we have available to us and a way that we can hybridize these plants, and even amateur growers can do that, can do this hybridization. And so it's very exciting, all these different strains we're getting. And doing your research on these are very important to know what you can grow in your home or in your garden. But yeah, that's exciting. Thank you.
Thanks, Phyllis. We appreciate that call. Okay, we have yet another email from our last gardening show. This says, we have a dead pine that we're taking down. This is from Chris. We have a dead pine we're taking down and wanting to put a pollinator garden in that spot. I'm thinking we'll have to create a raised bed to make planting easier because of the root system from the tree. What do you guys think? Also, would love suggestions for pollinator garden plants that are native to the area and will do well with little maintenance. I'm going to actually throw this one to you, Scott. I know, it's a bit of a curveball. Oh, you want to add something, Mary?
Yeah. Well, we talked about a little bit with the building the raised bed. You can save yourself some money on those materials that will hold that soil together. We would recommend sheet mulching, which basically is using cardboard in several layers to kill any of that weed seed bed that might come up now that it has light in order to germinate. And so you can have several layers of this cardboard mulching. You can put soil on top of that and compost. So I would put at least 3 to 4 inches if you can. But I don't know that I would invest in wood or other materials to kind of build that siding of the beds for native plants, because once they're established, they really don't need that extra piece. So you can save that for your veggie garden. and some of the recommendations I would give you are liatris, bee balm, goldenrod, echinacea, milkweed, and mountain mint. And I definitely don't want to forget about our grasses. Our native grasses are amazing. If you're planting a pollinator garden or any native plant garden, please consider adding some native grasses. So we have things like little blue stem, switchgrass, lovegrass, lots of different options for you. So give those a try. They are, a lot of them, set it and forget it. They're pretty well behaved, although some of our native plants can kind of spread to where we don't want them to all the time. but that's what I would recommend, is the sheet mulching and then getting some of those really sturdy natives in there.
Yeah.
You know, one thing you probably are going to have done is the stump removed, which isn't really removed. It's just ground up. So that's a lot of woody, nitrogen-consuming material that'll be left behind. So you might want to actually try to dig that out as much as you can and replace it with some soil, maybe even amend with some compost of some kind to add some nutrition. And then we do have on the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden website some a pollinator brochure of really good plants that are highly recommended for here.
Okay. Did you want to add something, Peter?
The only thing I was going to say is, you know, when you're doing these kind of prairies, native plant areas, is that, you know, start off conservatively small, and then as the plants fill in, then you can separate them and transplant them and then expand over time. A lot of people start off with a big, giant area and then not that many plants, and then you get a lot of stuff that comes up that you don't want. So sort of, you know, be more concise in your selection or compact, and then you can just naturally expand over time.
You don't want to get overwhelmed at the beginning, so that's really good advice.
Yeah. And it also saves you a ton of money.
Yes.
That's always good advice, saving money. Well, we'll be back to wrap up our gardening show in just a moment. If you've got a question, now's the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the home stretch of today's gardening show. My guests are Civic Garden Center Ecology Education Manager Mary Dudley, Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Extension Educator for Hamilton County, Joe Boggs, Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Manager of Botanical Garden Outreach, Scott Berline, and Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer, Peter Huttinger. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or by emailing talk@wvxu.org. We have some folks on the line. Hi, Emily. Thanks so much for calling, and thanks for your patience. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for having me. My question is, we have a lot of those little Lazarus lizards in our vegetation in our yard, and they scatter over our entryway stairs and so forth, and I'm just wondering, what is there anything you can do to get rid of them? I don't want to hurt them or kill them. I just want to make them want to go away.
You want them to move to somebody else's house.
That's right. Yeah.
Joe, do you have any lizard advice?
I really don't. I mean, that is a fascinating creature that that was originally introduced on purpose. There's quite a story behind that. We don't have enough time to talk about all that, but they originated around Milan, Italy, and it just happens that our location in Greater Cincinnati is perfect for them. They match up very well. So genetic studies done by a graduate student at University of Cincinnati show that they started with 10 lizards. So you have a genetic bottleneck pointing back to only 10 lizards were brought in to Greater Cincinnati. And there is a connection to the name Lazarus. But since that time, they've flourished. And honestly, I cannot think of a single thing that you can easily do, because they are just so successful in what we offer them in this area. Now, the upside is they feed on insects. So they are insectivores. They go out there and other creatures. So they're predators. And so the good news is that, you know, when they do arrive on the scene, you know, they can help to suppress some of the problems we have. But unless Peter or Scott, Scott, I don't know, with the zoo, you have them there as well. I don't know your perspectives, if you've come up with any ideas.
I have never spent 1 minute thinking about how to remove Lazarus lizards.
Are you a fan?
I love them. Yeah. I do.
I actually do too. Yeah.
They are a constant source of amusement for our cats and dogs, for one thing. And also the children in the community gardens. We have some rock piles that they love trying to dig them out of. I don't know. But I always thought they also did like eat other insects. So I always treated them as an asset. I don't know. Mary, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, we have a lot at the Civic Garden Center. And I will say, echoing all three of you, that they are something that we have fun with the kids. But birds will munch on them. So if you attract birds to your garden with a bird bath and maybe a service berry or another native tree or shrub, then you will have something else that can nibble on them a little bit. I've definitely seen the birds go into town.
I've seen many without tails.
Yes.
So. Yeah, their tails detached. That's the great, that's their...
Wow.
It's kind of embarrassing for them, but they detach as a defense mechanism.
I'm glad you're worried about the Lazarus's feelings, Joe. I think that's great. Well, Emily, I hope that helps. It looks like if you don't like those lizards, maybe you need to attract some birds.
Yeah,
so.
Or just make friends with them.
Or make friends with the lizards. Yeah. Or get a really hungry cat. Okay. We have another.
Or move to Milan. I think they all left Italy.
Yeah, I think.
That's right. They're in their summer home here in Cincinnati, right? Okay. Well, we have Mary on the line. Hi, Mary. Thanks for your call. What's your question?
Hi, yes. There were knockout roses that were planted last summer, and now they have copious amounts of yellow leaves, and the leaves are falling. And I understand from researching that that's from overwatering. So I'm wondering how to help them revive. And also, I have a lot of hostas that need to be divided, and I'm nervous about attempting that. I'm not sure how to proceed.
I can take the hosta part of it. Hostas divide extremely well, even now when they're leafed out. I would just dig them up and go for it. Just try to get clean cuts on them and do a little bit of care for them afterwards, a little watering when it gets dry. But otherwise, they should be fine. For the roses, that might be a Joe question.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I mean, there could be a connection to high soil moisture, but there also could very well be a connection to a couple other things we need to rule out. One, you know, have your soil tested. So have a soil test, because when we start seeing what we call chlorosis on the leaves, particularly early in the season, because we have different elements that can move, you know, from older foliage to newer foliage. So when things are growing very rapidly in the spring, we can sometimes see the older leaves turn yellow and drop. We can also have spider mites. So look underneath the leaves a little early for that. And then finally, and this is one that may seem a little bit out there, but we do have a virus that can cause mottling on the leaves. Now, this is a little early to see the symptomology, but we may start picking it up. If it doesn't get better as the season progresses, that could be a problem. The biggie for roses, though, is rose black spot, but we're not seeing that quite yet. It's too early in the season. So I just gave you a whole smorgasbord of things to consider. It's not usually just one thing, but you have to go through the process of elimination as to which one of these things might be the true culprit.
I hope that helps, Mary. Good luck with your knockout roses. I hope they are knockouts for you. Peter, I know we've got some more emails to get through, but first, you've got some community classes and home gardening classes coming up. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, we do a series of five classes that kind of take you through the steps of for beginning gardeners who are working at community gardens and also at home. And so you can get the information on those classes at the Turner Farm website, turnerfarm.org. And we'll be glad you can register those. The first class is full, but there's openings in the others. And our classes, there's a little bit of classroom work, but primarily everything is done in the community garden in Price Hill. And the classes are set up. We offer them a little later than most people because we try and have each subject correspond with what's actually happening in the garden.
Ah, okay.
So that's really important for us. And then also on our website, too, we were talking about when to plant different things. We do have a vegetable planting schedule. So if you go to the Community Garden Program page at the Turner Farm Community Garden website, you can download that as a PDF. That should be helpful.
Okay. Terrific. Well, let's answer a few more emails from our listeners. I got to scroll back. Okay. Chris emailed us, "I found large ant hills in my lawn. The ant hills are 12 inches in diameter. How do I get rid of the ants?" Joe, I'm going to turn to you for that.
Boy, great insect questions. Those are called field ants, and there are a couple different types of them. There's a black field ant, and then there's a yellow field ant. How do you like that, Scott? We're very creative in the naming of these things. They don't cause any great harm. I want to stress that, other than these mounds. And by the way, some of you may be out there thinking, and you'd be right, if we're a little further east, we might see really big mounds from the Allegheny mound ant. But we really don't have those in greater Cincinnati to any degree. So these are the field ants. And I want to stress, ants are the bedrock of our ecosystems. They're scavengers. So those ants are going out and scavenging for different things. They really don't cause any great harm. Yes, they can kind of cause overtop some turf grass a little bit. But if you're just raking the mounds out, that'll allow you to mow. But I don't recommend that we go after killing these, because again, they're providing such an important service.
Okay. Well, that's great. That takes care of that. You're pro Lazarus lizard, pro ant. We're getting all this information about you today, Joe. We had an email from Beth who has a question about homemade insecticidal sprays. Are there any recipes or just ingredients and ratios for homemade insecticidal sprays, specifically any recommended soaps to include and or any of which to steer clear? And then if there's time, any advice for preparing, boiling, soaking, blender, food processor, etc. to extract the most potent offense possible from peppers and garlic, etc. for use in a pump sprayer?
Yeah. Well, there's controversy among the guests about homemade insecticidal soaps, I can tell you that. I have a tendency not to want to buy anything. And so there are some things you do, but you do have to be very careful about the soap that you use, because a lot of these soaps are designed to really degrease. So a mild Castile soap is something if you're going to go with that. If someone wants to contact me through WVXU or the Turner Farm website, there are some recipes that we use. But also a good general insecticidal soap or product is just simply using neem oil. And when you buy the neem oil, there's instructions about the ratio to water. And what you do there is soap. You just put a little bit of soap they recommend putting in, and that's to help break down the oil so it emulsifies in the water. And so if you buy just straight natural neem oil, which is available just all over the place as well as the internet, Growing Trade's another good place for that. That's a really good, safe insecticidal soap to use. And then I guess you guys want to say something. Or...
Not me.
Oh, okay.
Well,
Joe does.
I'll tell you, in all my years with the extension, one of the most common things that we've gotten in terms of plant samples is phytotoxicity associated with homegrown recipes. And so it always starts with, I had this problem. I sprayed that. What's causing my, fill in the blank plant to be, the leaves to be turning brown. And so it's so common, we call that phytotoxicity. And as Peter pointed out, all soaps aren't equal. I mean, we move into detergents, for example. Mm-hmm. But I just simply, why do it when you can go and buy? And I know, Peter, you said none of us like to spend a lot of money on things, but you do have companies that produce insecticidal soaps. And that's exactly what they are. They are soaps that have been tested in university trials, non-biased research trials, to say that these work without damaging plants. It's on the label. So I understand, the do-it-yourself approach to things, but I have seen so many plants seriously injured. In fact, last year, a really nice Japanese maple that was gone, that just had to be replaced by someone putting together an, you know, a do-it-yourself concoction. And so, yeah, we do have a little bit of a different opinions on this, but just go buy what's labeled for the use on that plant.
And then I'm going to say, you read the label and follow the label. Because,
oh, good for you, Mary. Yeah. Oh, yes.
You can overapply those. So
yes, you can.
Be careful.
Yeah, don't.
Yeah, like what I was talking about, the neem oil, that's a really good point. You know, putting in a, you know, spraying it directly on the plant's not a good thing. I mean, there's instructions on these things. And if it tells you to use a tablespoon, use a tablespoon. You know, because if you use 2 tablespoons, it's not going to improve the performance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to add, make sure you need to spray it before you do.
Yeah.
Don't jump
Absolutely.
At, don't jump at the first sign of anything. Make sure you know the insect and whether it's something you need to even worry about.
Okay. Yeah, and aphids is a good example of that. On vegetable plants, tomatoes and peppers, you'll have some. You can spray those insects off with the your hose, you know, gently, and then when you transplant the plant out in the garden and it's exposed to direct sunlight, you generally almost, they almost never come back.
Yeah. Joe, we're going to see just how tolerant you are of various insects because we got an email from Julia who says, we have chiggers in our backyard that make it annoying to go outside and enjoy our yard during the summer. Any good methods for getting rid of them permanently or temporarily for a dinner party? Are you pro-chigger, Joe?
No. And chiggers are just simply a challenge. You know, they don't like to have, they don't do well under really dry conditions. So keeping the lawn mowed, you know, properly, maintaining, you know, proper cut, also trying to keep, you know, vegetation back. And so you're keeping things drier. On the other hand, you will find hot spots right in the middle of a well mowed lawn. And that's been documented. We don't know what's going on there. Maybe a little seep or something keeps the moisture high. If you're going to have a dinner party, that may be something that you, you know, might want to seek the help of a professional to, you know, suppress the chiggers. And I just have to say that that sometimes is a requirement. I think I can speak for all the guests that, you know, as Scott said, we don't like to see people spray unless they absolutely have to. But if you have a clear and present challenge with chiggers that may be for your party, but not doing year-round because you're going to kill other things, that may be the solution.
Okay. Well, we've found Joe Boggs' limits. I have been talking with Civic Garden Center Ecology Education Manager Mary Dudley, Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Extension Educator for Hamilton County, Joe Boggs, Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Manager of Botanical Garden Outreach, Scott Berline, and Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer, Peter Huttinger. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.